Mr. Whittaker, Reel 10. We were talking about the events of Easter Monday in Tobruk and the enormous land and air battle that was going on all around you and your impressions of it.
Yes.
Would you like to continue?
As far as my recollections of it, it had quietened down by about lunchtime, or because time, in these things, what's always impressed me, time, you lose all track of time. What seemed like hours could be in a few minutes. But anyway, everything, eventually, it quietened down.
Now, did you come under artillery fire, the position?
Not that I can remember. We escaped fairly light. There was a lot of stuff exploding in front of us, but it was short of our gun positions.
And do you know how well, I mean, you talked about when it brought down fire on the gun, you know, the OP post. Do you know how effective the fire was?
We found out later in the day that apparently what happened, the German infantry just nicely got on there, and of course our fire, which is never pinpoint, and of course we're firing with 8 guns, and as I said, by coordinates. But apparently it really broke up the whole thing. And it gave, and the tanks, which the infantry were supporting, they'd gone on. And the infantry no longer had their protection. And it broke the whole thing up. Some of the tanks got shot up, because they sat there forever during the siege. We used to pass them time after time. And the whole thing, eventually, the tanks retreated, the infantry, they went. But the chief thing that I do remember, the place which was pointed out to us later, some of the Germans attempted to, there was an old mud walled house, no roof on it, and the Australians, what they did, they got close on through a hand grenade in amongst them. I don't think there was much talk of putting the hands up. I'm afraid, as I say, there was days like that, they just sort of, they did bring some prisoners back. We saw a few prisoners going back, but not many. But so it all quietened down.
And all through the battle, you were in the spare capacity.
We went out, we did go out, whether it was later that afternoon, but we did go and...
In X-car?
With an ordinary, with one or two other signals, in an ordinary 1500 weight. No, by that time, I don't know, I'd been put back onto the signal thing, and we went and mended the, made sure that the wires were okay. We didn't go right up to the OP because there was still firing going on, but we certainly went and mended telephone wires and laid others. We laid communications all over the place, mainly because we were cooperating with First RHA.
And did you when you laid wires, did they just go over the surface of the desert then?
Just went on the surface.
So very vulnerable.
Oh yes, this was the trouble. Vehicles would break, and if it was hard underneath, and it would break the wire, and probably break it inside and leave the outer case okay. So you'd go up with a safety pin and push it through and just check.
How would you check? You'd ring back to...
Just ring back, and which in a moment I'll tell you number two of my 3 clangers. But it did quiet down. The only, and for the next few days, apart from spasmodic, brief intervals of, I say, fighting, where we fired and there were air raids, the most notable thing that everybody remembers was the last of the Hurricanes. And he went up, this was one afternoon, early afternoon, and there were 3 110s. They were twin engined. They were the twin engine mesh, and they were flying in a Vic, and this hurricane dived on them from a very patchy little bit, a faint wisp of cloud, and you could see the tracer from these 3 mesh, straight on him. And he kept coming all the way, absolute, never, his dive continued almost vertical, in between our gun position and 426, who were further over to the east. Straight into the ground, and like, oh dear, everybody remember him, Flying Officer Lamb. Cause I think most, they put a, I don't know whether it's some of our people went up, but certainly, by the time I went and looked later on, there was a little, there was a rough wooden cross or something stuck up, and his name then, I think his dog tags or something. And all that was left was a big smoking hole nearby where this thing had gone deep into the ground. But everybody remember, you know, because he was high up and everybody could see him, but he had no hesitation in attacking these 3.
Did you have a lot of time for the, I mean, the RAF? I mean, did you respect what they were doing for you, or trying to do for you?
I did. I was, as I say, I've always been aeroplane mad. And the thing I can remember just after, when we'd got settled into Brook, we used to get these intelligence reports, and one that particularly impressed us, that told us what the German Air Force had got. They'd got Stukas, the Ju-80s and the Ju-87s, they'd got 110s, they'd got a few Dorniers, the Flying Pencils, some reconnaissance aircraft, and Ju-88s, the bombers, twin engine general purpose plane, but they said they haven't got any fighters. So we wondered what the hell these single engine things with the big black and white spinners that kept diving at us were.
Now, the Stuka attack started to come in on the gun positions.
Yes.
What do you remember about that? And could you describe what a, not perhaps a typical Stuka, or one you remember in particular, attack
one
was like?
One in particular, I was up on my own at the time. There were several of us out, but we were checking a line. And I was, I don't know, half a mile or so from the gun position. On my way back, we'd not, as I say, we'd gone out walking, you know, not with the truck. And we were checking this line, which we wanted to make sure, and we found it okay. There were one or two breaks, that's why, you know, you'd find one, and then the next chap would go up, check it, oh no, it's still not right, so while you were mending that, the other chap would go further up, and so on. And on my way back, the Stukas came over. There were Vicks of 3, and to my horror, they dropped into their line astern, and the big circle was right over Fort Palestrina, where all our guns were. And they downed the, couldn't say how many there were, no, there were always quite a number. And I got as flat as I could on the deck, and they looked to me, it looked like they were bombing right on our gun positions. And it turned out when I got back, it was a single, but then they said they used to come down and then they'd streak off. They all coming back over my head, you know, they used to come, they used to fly back about 50 feet up. When they died, they simply levelled out and went for home. And it was, they'd bombed around our B troop, particularly, where one of, where we'd lost, I think there were 2 people, where we found there were 2 people killed. One was a signal sergeant, Collie Hole, who I knew quite, not a particular friend of mine, but I did know him quite well. He was a signal sergeant. And one of the senior sergeants, Smedley, who'd been in charge of us when we were in our first position on the famous protecting the Suez Canal. So I knew him. He was a very efficient, and he got killed somehow. leftist slip trench or gun position or whatever, and got killed on the court in the open. We were very lucky, because it was quite a... That was the first big Stuka raid I saw close to.
And it looked worse than it was then?
Yes, because a lot of the bombs missed the target. So, and when they fell in sand, there was the most enormous explosion, but a lot of the stuff went upwards. There was nothing, you didn't get this blast effect that's so dangerous in the, where they were building. But it was a frightening, it was a frightening experience. It began to bring home to you, just what the... how dangerous the Germans really were.
Do you remember any other Stuka raids?
They were usually, they concentrated an awful lot on the port, so they were going over our heads. They did bomb other gun positions, but we, as I say, we got away with it quite lightly.
So you were sort of not actually in a gun position when it was bombed?
I was never actually in a gun position when they came right at us. I did have one. I was once on a telephone line again, mending a line, when I saw one actually drop a bomb bang slap on a big red cross, which annoyed me considerably. It was a single Stuka, and he was flying as though he was coming back from the harbour, and he'd still got the bomb on. And he wasn't ever so far back, but he dived, and there was a red cross station clearly marked. These were a lot of Italian positions, and it had a concrete, almost like a helicopter landing pad. Helicopters weren't invented then, by the way, but it had this big red cross clearly painted, and it planted this thing. I bet it was only about a couple of hundred yards from me. A short dive, and wham, this wretched thing, a blue piece of concrete all over them. Why he did it, I shall never know. I think he was just getting rid of I think maybe his bomb had hung up and he one last go to get rid of it.
Now, how did you develop your gun positions and what efforts did you make at camouflage with all this air activity?
This was all done, you had a lot of the work was done when you could. And gradually they did dig deeper, sandbag higher, and got the nets over. We were digging slip trenches, and not only slip trenches, beginning to cover them in, so we'd have somewhere to sleep at night and feeling a bit protected, find any old bits of timber or whatever, and then put a sandbag so you could just get in and at least have your head covered, put your blankets on there.
Would it develop as far as, for instance, the you had done at Mercer, you got...
No, there wasn't the material there. We never did get as elaborate as that. But gradually it did, we did get, the gun pits particularly got deeper and done little things at the side, sort of slip trench, if you can understand me, little slip trenches off them. Places to protect the ammunition. During this time, I got posted for a time as a liaison signaller with the 1st RHA.
I wanted to ask about the cooperation with the 1st RHA. They must have been more efficient than at the start. So people always say that they were more efficient at the start, but then the South Knots got better.
Yes.
Not necessarily better than the 1st RHA, but got better and better.
Yes, I should imagine so. I did my job and we weren't particularly concerned about it in the case of doing what we were told.
And what did you actually have to do as liaison signaller?
We laid a telephone line. There were two of their people and a chap called Major Lona Simmons, who later, when I got home, I found he'd become very famous. He dropped into Ireland with the artillery. How do you drop obviously bad enough for me on the ground, how you drop artillery, but he did become, but he was, and he would coordinate fire. He would actually tell me what he wanted and I would relay it back. I must have been attached, I suppose, to our command post, the 45 command post. Second clanger, the line went dead once, and I went out in the middle of the night to repair it. And I made a really classic boob. Got down this line and found a break and repaired it. And said something like, checking telephone, and the voice answered, and I said, you know, 107 or 425 or something, checking telephone line, and the voice said, yes, the line's okay. So I thought, well, that's all right, and I went back to the Major Simmons, this dugout place, and got my head down. I was awoke about an hour later with a very irate signal, Sergeant Mr. Gore, who blew my head. And of course, what I'd done, the chap at first RHA had answered me. I'd said 107, so he'd assumed it was the 107th line. So we'd cut it. But it, in other words, I'd got back to my own telephone, and the break was on the other side. Oh dear. Apart from a chewing up, which I must admit I deserved, I could only plead that I was dog tired. Another thing about those first few days, of course, in Tobruk, or first few weeks even, we weren't allowed to wash and shave.
Why not?
There was no shave, no water. So that lasted, I don't think it lasted, I say, weeks. And I think actually I was washed and shaved by the time I got to first RHA. I don't think they'd have had me unwashed. But they were a bit superior, did these.
In what way? How did it show itself?
Not in any particular way. I just felt, I probably felt inferior to these. They were both NCOs who were with Major Simmons. And, you know, but they got on very well.
Was the discipline different from it in the territorial unit? I mean, were they noticeably stricter?
Only about these polished bits on the guns. But I don't think there were any, I think our discipline, well, it was maybe a bit different, but I don't think that it was pretty much the same. And of course, we worked with the same, this of course is training, isn't it? We worked with the same rules, you know, the fire orders and things were just the same, so it seemed to work, you know, we seemed to get on with them quite well.
And how long were you on that job for?
I can't really remember. A few days, maybe a week or two. I can't, as I say, this first part. The thing that does puzzle me, I know in our regimental history, there they've got our signal sergeant, Jack Gore, as a WO2. But I've got a sneaky feeling that sometime during those first during Tobruk was where we lost Greensmith, and I'm not absolutely certain, but I can remember that certainly it was Sergeant Gore who posted me up to first RHA. And the next thing with Tobruk, it had settled down a bit, and then they got this thing with the sailor where the Germans attacked and got a They got a salient, they got this big bulge in the defences to the west on the Derna side.
What do you remember about that?
We went up one day, one day after they'd taken this, they'd had a terrible time with mortars. The Germans had these very big mortars. And we took, and I don't know if this was when we'd got a glamour troop or before, but we took a couple of 4.5 howitzers. We got to shoot over a hill to try and knock out these mortars. The ordinary guns couldn't reach them. And this was that was a most nerve-wracking.
You were attached to glamour troop.
I just went up as a gun position signaller. But gun position, the OP, the chap stood against the guns. It was on a hillside, and where the Germans were was on a hill a bit away. They overlooked us, their hill was higher than ours. But we fired a few rounds, but nothing particular happened, and we went back home. But they'd had a lot of, they'd had quite a lot of people killed that morning. Another thing with the sailors, at the time, we'd settled down with them, we'd got into a routine, and I'm not sure, we split up from 1st RHA after a time, simply by moving gun positions. They took over ours on the western side, we took over some. In other words, there were, the gun positions were there, and it was simply a question of moving the troops. So there's all 425s were together, and all 1st RHA. Although we still kept in close liaison.
Now you were settling into a routine. What would your routine be as a slightly spare signaller? You know,
keeping telephone lines going, checking constantly. Wires were constantly being broken because the line to our OP, the line to the OPs was right alongside a main. It was like a, well, it was a track, very clearly marked, and you were right alongside, and trucks had only got to deviate, which they didn't always stick to it, and they'd break the line.
So you were acting mainly as a linesman, as opposed to a telephone operator?
Occasionally you'd get to, you'd take your turn at night, for instance, because the telephones were always manned on the gun positions, so you'd have a turn at night on the telephones. They were always on the gun position, and occasionally command post, they swap them round. The command post had an exchange there, 210 liners.
That's battery.
The battery command post, yeah, for two troops.
And what about the use of wirelesses? I mean, you've got the telephones. Would you use the wireless as well, or not?
Not an awful lot. It was mostly telephones in Tobruk. You kept the radio, you checked them, and they did have a wireless up at the OP, and it was checked. You also had a wireless in the command post.
Would you use them if the lines went down? I mean,
yes.
If
yes. As soon as the line went down, you.
So it was a backup?
It was a backup.
Why was the telephone preferred?
I never thought about it. Was
the wireless a voice one? I mean, could you talk over it, or was it Morse?
No, it had both facilities, but it was voice. The microphones had a thing they called a presser switch, and you pressed it, you know, you pressed the switch when you were talking, and then said over. You know, it was...
So you wouldn't use them much? In this routine you established, what sort of, food were you getting at that time? Rations?
Bully beef, biscuits. The food, it was a problem. Everything had to be brought up by boat or ship. And they, it was a... food and water. We used to have people go scrounging for water. In other words, could they find a well that nobody had found? As well as the official rations which they went and drew, they were always, we'd always got people scrounging around, and they did at one time find some. This story went round, they'd had to push a dead Italian body over to one side to fill the tins, but there was always a dead body in the well. In the desert, you know, this was the one of these stores. But water was scarce. When we did start shaving, I know I used two razor blades to get down to the accepted level. But we'd often use the remains of the tea.
How was your water issued? Was it issued as tea, or would you get a water?
You got your water bottle full, And then you got tea from the cookhouse. You know, you'd get a mug of tea, and if you're lucky, you might get, if there was some left over, you'd go and scrounge it, and probably use tea without milk and sugar, and have a shave if you've got enough. Anything like that.
Did you have? I mean, you keep your water in your water bottle. Then. Was there water discipline enforced? Were you supposed to not drink it straight away?
It was supposed to last just the full day or whatever. You were told very firmly that it was rationed and that you didn't waste it.
You scrounge it. Would there be any way of getting any from the stores? I mean, were there...
No, they'd bring the water tank up, as far as I can remember, you'd fill your bottle and that was it. It was a case of people going out and filling and trying to find an unofficial.
Were you thirsty? Overall? You know?
Sometimes, yes. The trouble is, when you know there's not a lot of water, you always want to drink it. When it's there, you don't bother about it.
Was it an inconvenience or was it pretty desperate? I mean, you know.
Inconvenience. But it did. He did talk about it. You know, it was when things are short, it didn't really be talked. You know, let's say with food, people began to talk about meals they'd had in Kyle's and Zandru's such places.
Did they try and, I mean, you mentioned bully beef and biscuits. That's all you can remember.
Yep. Mainly for the beef and jam.
And how would this serve it up? I mean,
make it into stew with biscuits. I can't remember if they sometimes got tins of stew and things with it. A lot of times it had been, but it was mainly bully beef with biscuits and a bit of mustard. They can make it taste a bit better. In the mornings, the great thing was. As far as I remember, but a lot of us, I know whether it started then, you'd make your own. We started, you know, there was quite a lot of, later on, it was a lot of individual cooking and other places. But in the morning, the big thing was, got the biscuits, soaked them over, probably a few biscuits soaked them overnight. And then in the morning, some sugar, and cook it, and it came like porridge, known as biscuit burgoon. Which was the staple diet for those who could stand it in the mornings. It was quite substantial. Can't remember seeing the bread. Did have a cake, eventually, which had a big, my mother and father had sent me a parcel, and this arrived with a stump on the label, recovered from the harbour by divers of the Royal Navy. Tasted a bit salty, and the cigarettes were, some of them were a bit, weren't exactly.
What would be in the parcel? I mean, you mentioned two things.
Well, there was a cake, cigarettes, and some chocolate. And the chocolate, I remember, that was uneatable. And it's been these ships used to get bombed. They came within daylight at first. And